Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
Pauline Price, good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon, Colin. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. When did you last see your son, Luke?
I would have seen my son, Luke, shortly before Christmas. As he had intended to spend Christmas with his girlfriend in Limerick. And I've spoken to him a number of times before he disappeared. But yeah, it would have been just shortly before Christmas that I saw him, unfortunately.
And when did he disappear?
So he disappeared on January 14th at about 9:10 in the evening.
And what part of the country was he in when he went missing?
Okay, so he was visiting his friend in Limerick City. And it was from that address that he disappeared.
Okay.
Literally without a trace.
Can you tell us a bit about him? What age was he and what did he like doing?
Okay, so Luke is 27. He's a very capable, very able young man in many respects. He enjoys reading, largely online because he has dyslexia, and when he's reading online, it's easier because he can alter the font to suit his own needs. But he's an avid reader. He's a gamer. He enjoys experimenting with food flavours, which he always has done, which has led him into chefing as a career. In the past, he's enjoyed hiking and camping and various outdoor activities. But more recently, it's been a case of Mum, I need to develop hobbies.
Okay.
So he had just shortly before he disappeared, bought himself a very nice Nikon digital camera, and his intention was to get into photography.
Right, so a pretty creative individual into, as you say, photography, developing an interest in that, and had a talent. You said he was interested in experimenting with flavours, and the like. Mm. He had worked in the catering industry and was a pretty accomplished cook, wasn't he?
Oh, very much so. He started at the bottom of the line as my brain is scrambled.
It's okay. It's not an easy thing to talk about. So yeah, I can appreciate that. We'll have to stop and start, and that's no problem at all. Just take your time. So he got in, as you say, at the ground floor. Was it a catering course?
Yeah, he did a CTAC Level 5 catering course in Tullamore at the LOETB. Got on very well with that. And once he qualified, he took himself off to the UK, got himself a fantastic job at the Royal Automobile Club, which it's a very exclusive members-only club, where essentially he learned his trade. Having learnt the basics on his culinary course, he learnt the trade at the RAC. And so at the bottom of the line, starting as a commis chef, he went up to chef de partie, and his last job, his current job before he went missing, he would have been a senior chef de partie in an extremely nice, again, exclusive setting,
nice.
Which has won numerous awards. He's worked with very professional people and has been, rewarded, shall we say.
Right. I mean, I think most people can hear from your voice. You're pretty proud of him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's stood on his own two feet. He's been counted and he's accomplished a nice bit or two all on his own. And, yeah, very proud of him and very proud of both of my sons. They're both amazing, very capable young men.
Right. You probably had a bit of an input into that yourself.
I hope so.
Yeah. Okay, so he moved to the UK, and then he spent a number of years there, did he? He was about 20 when he moved to the UK, was he?
Thereabouts.
Yeah, and he moved home after a number of years, and he was in Ireland. He was working here, was he?
He was. He was very lucky. He approached a couple of agencies when he came home. Obviously with a view to getting employment. I had a couple of interviews, and then I took him one afternoon in October for a very cold, rainy, horrible October afternoon for an interview. And on the way to another interview afterwards, he spent the afternoon being interviewed and being assessed on a work trial, and basically he got that job.
Okay,
so it was, I think, his third interview. The other two really, they weren't suited to his experience at all, but he just wanted to get his foot on the employment ladder.
Yeah, and it's a skill that's very much in demand. I think restaurants and pubs around the country are looking for chefs, particularly ones as skilled as Luke. So he was living with you at the time. He moved in then to the accommodation that came with the job. Is that right?
Yeah. So not too far from home, half an hour drive.
Okay, and where is home?
He doesn't drive himself. We live just outside Tullamore, County Offaly. But he doesn't drive himself, so it was prices, taxis, or paying for an actual taxi to go anywhere. So it's costly business when you don't live in the town. But you know, he was very, very capable. He got on. He did. Got himself an electric scooter after a little while, having borrowed my bicycle for the first few months. And then in all weathers, up the road in the snow, the rain, the ice.
Okay, so not afraid of hard work or adverse conditions. Not only did he get himself an electric scooter, he got himself a girlfriend as well, did he?
He did.
And she was...
He did. And
she was based in Limerick.
Again, in Limerick.
Right, in the city, is it?
In the city, yeah. Smack bang in the middle of the city. And in fact, it was... he'd gone to visit her on the evening that he went missing. And she was the last person to see him. So the whole thing has been very difficult on all of us. Only it's been especially difficult on her because she was the last person to see him.
Okay, so in as much detail as you're comfortable with giving with this, tell us about that day, the 14th of January, what his movements were when you were in contact with him, and what's known about his movements before he went missing.
So about mid-morning, I contacted him just basically to see how he was and how his Christmas party had been the previous week. And he's like, oh, I didn't go to it, Mum. I'm like, oh, really? You weren't feeling too well then? It's like, no, but I'm better now. And so we had like a little chat, me giving him a little bit of a pep talk and, you know, the G-up, congratulating him on everything he's achieved, etc. And, you know, telling him that I hoped he had a nice time down in Limerick and when was he going to come and see us? Because he was actually on holiday at that time.
Okay, this is post Christmas. The rush had died down. It's the 14th of January, 2025, the day
exactly.
You're talking to him. Yeah.
You know, a lot of hotels and restaurants, they take holidays, closures in January. And so he was a free agent. We had a bit of a chat by messenger. I'm like, oh, I suppose you're going to go down and see herself. So, I'm just heading off there now, Mum. So he was actually talking to me by messenger when he was on the train on his way down there.
Okay.
And, you know, he seemed quite realistic in his expectations and experience of himself.
Okay.
Shall we say?
I hope I'm not intruding here, but what do you mean by that?
Well, from time to time, Luke has suffered with anxiety and depression, and he had been quite low before he came home from the UK. And so, of course, I've been keeping an eye on him. We all have, just because it's a transition, and transition change is difficult for the best of us. So we've all tried to be as supportive as we can be. As we were able to be, and that's really what I mean by seeing me, who wasn't feeling up to going to the Christmas party. And I'm like, you know, physical, mental, whichever. And it's like, yeah, but I'm okay now. And it would appear that actually he wasn't.
Okay. And look, he obviously didn't lack courage either, because for somebody who has to deal with, you know, anxiety to go into a job, a busy job that requires a lot of contact with people, like a kitchen where there's constant pressure and everything else, for him to be able to discharge that kind of a job, managing what he was managing, you know, speaks to a lot of resilience on his part as well.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. Mm. Chefing's not an easy job. It's not a job for the fair-hearted.
No.
The faint-hearted, I should say.
Even if people's experience of that is only particularly angry television chefs, I think people get a sense of what kitchens are like. So on the 14th of January, he's on the way down. You're messaging him and you're in contact with him up until the point he arrives in Limerick. Is that right?
I'm not sure at what point we closed our conversation, but certainly it would have been before he got to Limerick Junction, because he wasn't on a direct train. So what we've been able to ascertain is that the last but one sighting of Luke Price, in fact, one of the photographs that we've used on the posters, was him at Limerick Junction, having come down off the steps, presumably changing platform. He appears to be looking at a phone as he's walking, and so this is how we know exactly what he was wearing.
Okay. Do you mind me asking, what was he wearing?
So he was wearing a pair of jeans, black boots. He had a pink T-shirt on and a black jacket, which I believe to be his black wax barber jacket.
Okay.
But it was a short-length, hip-length jacket, as I say, black. And I believe later in the day, he had also acquired from somewhere, we don't know where, a blue Aran type of jumper.
Okay.
But that would have been his ensemble for the day.
So he was sighted at Limerick Junction, but he did arrive in Limerick and was in contact with his girlfriend, was he?
Yeah, he was. Apparently the train had been delayed somewhat, and their normal routine would be that he would let her know when the train was due in. She then would nip down to the railway station, and then they'd spend the day in whatever way they'd intended. So on this occasion, apparently the train was late. She hadn't heard from him, so I believe this is the way things went, because I think, you know, obviously this is second-hand information,
sure.
But my understanding is that essentially she rang him because she was a little bit concerned, because he hadn't rung her when she thought he was due to. And at this point, he told her that the train was late in and that when he got into Limerick, he would ring her. Only he didn't. So I believe a couple of hours later, you know, it was a case of, right, okay, you know, where are you? At which point he'd already arrived in Limerick and he's walking around the city centre looking at the Google Trace My Phone facility.
Okay.
It appears that he was walking around the city from the railway station to a cafe, a pub, and I think another couple of shops on the way down to the statue of Terry Wogan by the river,
okay.
which seemingly is his favourite spot in the city.
The statue of Terry Wogan?
Yes.
Right, okay. Is that going back to, like, was he an admirer of, like, Terry Wogan in his time in the UK? He has kept that up then, has he, since a lifelong love of Terry Wogan?
I shouldn't have thought so.
Right.
I used to listen to Terry when I was pregnant with his brother living in the UK. And occasionally, you know, when I was working in James's and commuting, there's a spot up by the Brendan Grace place. Was it Blackthorn Inn, is it called now, I think? Where I used to be able to catch Terry in the mornings for about 10 minutes and then it would disappear. So
is that between the Black Church Inn and the Putchin still there on the N7?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
And of course, when you're in heavy traffic, that translates to about 10 minutes.
Okay.
But,
so anyway, he found his way to the statue. Terry, unbeknownst to Terry, the late Terry Wogan, was one of the family, and he went down to visit the statue. So
lovely photo again, which has been used on the Look for Luke campaign of him sitting on Terry's lap.
Okay, on the 14th of January, on that day or on another day?
Oh no, on a different day.
On a nice
sunny day with a smile on his face.
Okay.
But we have used that in, you know, part of the Look for Luke campaign. Because obviously the way we see it is that the more photographs of Luke in different situations with facial hair, without facial hair, with short hair, long hair, greasy hair, you know, tied back hair, whatever, the more photographs of him in different situations that we're able to circulate, the more likely was the possibility.
Okay.
The possibility is of people recognising him.
And did he ultimately meet his girlfriend on that day or on that night at this stage as it was in Limerick?
He did actually meet her and she went down to Terry and Luke and then they went back into the city and I believe they went for a pint, just wandering, doing what young couples do before they went back to her house. And as they were near the Chinese supermarket, I think, you know, it's, well, what do you fancy for dinner tonight? It's like, no, don't worry about me, I'm not stopping tonight. And which she thought was somewhat odd. Because normally if he went down to see her, he'd stay overnight and probably for a couple of days. But in this instance, he basically said, look, I'm only staying for a few hours.
And did he indicate to her
very odd
why or where he intended to travel if he wasn't staying with her?
No.
No, okay.
No, and I'm sure, I don't know, perhaps she didn't like to push him too much, but I'm sure she asked him. But there was no information forthcoming, unfortunately. So it's something of a mystery as to what his intentions were on that evening.
Right. His brother that you mentioned lives in Limerick as well, does he?
He does, yes. They would meet up, you know, fairly regularly. In fact, he would have met the girlfriend. My other son is a musician and a singer. And he actually would have met his girlfriend at one of my other son's gigs.
Okay, so a creative family so far. You've got a photographer,
very
chef, and
so
a musician in the family.
Yes. So, they would have spent a lot of time in one another's company. And, you know, as two couples, they would have spent a lot of time, you know, going to one another's for meals or games nights or just.
And I suppose as a result,
reacquainting themselves.
Yeah, he would have known Limerick pretty well.
Reasonably well.
Yeah.
But not as well as his older brother, because his older brother has been there for, the best part of 5-6 years.
Okay.
Possibly more.
So at what point did he part company with his girlfriend, and how long was it then between that point and when, herself, his brother and yourself, when was it that you became concerned that he was missing?
So it's kind of odd. From what I understand, somewhat abruptly, he got up, shook himself off, popped his jacket on and said, right, I'm off. And she followed him down and was pleading with him not to go and, please come back, or can you wait a second, let me put my shoes on, which were upstairs, what have you. And it's like, no, I'm off now. And literally off he went. So he left the front door, walked down the road in the direction of the dock road, and she saw him head in that direction, literally threw on a pair of trousers and shoes, legged it out the door after him, but by this point, he had vanished. When she'd been looking for about half an hour, from the offset, she knew there was something wrong, instinctively. By half an hour or thereabouts, she was absolutely convinced that there was something wrong, and I believe contacted his older brother, and then the two of them and my older son's girlfriend, they started to search the area. Within the hour, still no sign of him, which kind of, while Limerick is a big city, there are areas of Limerick which are quite small. And for him to disappear just so abruptly and with absolutely no trace of him, they had reported him missing by 11 o'clock that night.
And you mentioned there that you had looked on his phone, the tracking function on his phone, and you'd seen where he had gone around in the city. Where was the last sighting of his phone on that? Do you remember?
Literally, it would have been in the area he went missing from. It's not an exact science because, it really isn't the way it's shown on CSI. It pings off, 3 towers, I think, and from that they can get an approximate location. Mm. So each time I looked on it, it was literally in and around the area that he had gone missing. But, on one occasion it was from the girlfriend's house, another occasion it was the road behind him.
Okay.
But it was all in that area of the city, the Mount Lucas part of the city.
And at what point then did the search scale up into a full-on Dort? Sorry, what was the name of the Mount?
Mount Kennet would be the general area that they live in.
And at what point did the search scale up then into, Gardaí, volunteers, the whole bit, door-to-door, searching various areas of the city? How long did that take?
Yeah, well, my other half went down the following day, as did various family members and friends. So the volunteer force, so to speak, they would have been initiated very quickly. Then the Limerick Treaty Suicide Watch, they patrolled the riverbank, not every night of the week, but several times a week. So they were drafted in very quickly by my son. And then I think, you see, I was up in County Offaly. I have been advised to stay at home in case by some divine intervention he found his way home.
Right. Yes, yeah, somebody had to be back in the home place in case he looped back and went there. Okay, which must have been very
absolutely
tough. When people are out searching, they feel they're doing something active. Whereas you're pacing a room at home, looking at the phone, listening for the doorbell and that kind of thing. So it's a tough station to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you feel very helpless. And at the same time, I mean, one way around that was to actively become involved in the search by gaining access to Luke's laptop and to actually see could I coordinate with the various rescue associations, etc. So there was a lot of proactive involvement by the various members of the family from a very early stage.
And were you able to trace any street or commercial CCTV or dash cam footage or any of those kind of things? No.
No. In the area that he disappeared in, there are a number of cameras which either weren't working or they're dummy cameras.
Okay.
There were some very grainy images picked up in areas which basically make sense, but they can't be confirmed as Luke because they were so grainy that even his own brother and his stepdad couldn't identify him from these images. But common sense has eventually led to the belief that these images of persons near the river and crossing the river, there must have been Luke, given the time frame. But there has been absolutely nothing. It took a month to obtain the first CCTV to confirm the girlfriend's story that he had left and his direction of travel and the time. There was a car spotted coming up the street. They weren't able to get the license number from it. The CCTV on the railway station, the train, the bus station, the buses, literally.
Okay.
Between the Gardaí and our volunteer, our family and friends volunteer force, virtually every CCTV camera in the city and Ring doorbell have been examined, or requests have been made, and the footage eventually got hold of.
Okay.
But it's bizarre the way he's just vanished into midair.
Which leaves you with no satisfactory answers, and I'm sure, you know, you must have feared the very worst when,
absolutely,
at the time, you know, given that he was last sighted near the river, and yet you don't have any answers. And
none.
You have to deal with this uncertainty of him being missing, and as you say, missing without trace.
Well, yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, you know, it's very easy to be pessimistic. It's very easy to be overly optimistic. And somewhere down the middle, we have the reality of our situation. My other son, while he hopes against hope that Luke will come home, he has stated in a newspaper article recently that he believes it's too long. It's unlikely that Luke will come home. On the other hand, you know, I'm still hoping that maybe he did go walkabout out in West Clare, and maybe he's been taken in by a community who are looking after him. But we have no answers, and we really haven't got a clue.
Had he ever gone missing before?
No. He had gone for a walk once or twice. You know, he got up and gone for a walk, perhaps inappropriately. If he wasn't particularly enjoying the night out, he might go for a walk and come back again.
Okay.
But he'd never done this for more than an hour or so. So this whole episode is very much out of character for Luke. Very much.
And after the initial, as you say, there was, you know, a major effort by volunteers, everybody helping out. That can only be sustained for so long. So how long did that intensive part of the search go on for? And what has it been like then since that was scaled down?
So I'm sorry, I don't remember the date of the big storm. But basically, the red warning, you know, the really big hurricane-type storm that we had back in January, that basically put the kibosh on the major search. Prior to that, we had Tipperary Search and Rescue, with the Maritime Search and Rescue, with the Fire Department Search and Rescue.
Every possible state agency.
Bonratti, they were doing the search and rescue, and the Coast Guard, the 115, they joined in with the search and rescue up to and including the storm.
Okay.
But obviously, once that storm warning kicked in, it hampered the search effort. And then afterwards, obviously, people have their lives to go back to.
And you have no indication that, you know, he spent a number of years in the UK. Was there any sign of withdrawal of money or travel documents or anything like that? Because he didn't go back to the UK, did he?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
And not to the knowledge of the Gardaí. So that was a fear that we had initially. But I have his passport. And the Gardaí did contact the passport office to confirm whether or not a new passport, it had been reported as lost or stolen, and a new passport issued, and also to find out if he had the you know, the plastic travel card, which he doesn't. So neither of those two things have been done. So the hope is that he is still in Ireland. I mean, obviously there is no actual concrete way of confirming that he is, but all we can do is hope that he is. But of course, in order to obtain a ferry ticket, you still have to produce some degree of identification, and the names apparently are still entered into the ship's manifest. And without a passport, air travel is impossible.
Yeah, and any and all of those ports and ways of traveling would be well covered by CCTV.
Yeah, well, you would hope so. Yeah.
And Pauline, look, obviously you're talking to us today because you live in hope, and you're making an appeal for anyone who knows anything about your son since he was last seen on the 14th of January to make contact with the authorities. The Missing Persons Helpline is 1-800-442-552, and anyone with any amount of information, I presume, no matter how small or unimportant or how vague or anything else, you would encourage them to contact that helpline, 1-800-442-552.
Absolutely. Okay. Somebody out there has to know something. Now, there is a possibility that he may have assumed a different name, because he apparently in recent months he has been using his middle name, which is Gabriel.
Right.
So he may be going under the name of Gabriel.
Okay.
And my maiden name is Kelly. He may be assuming the name Gabriel Kelly. Somebody has to know something out there. And as a family, we need to know that he's okay. Obviously, we'd encourage him to come home. He hasn't done anything wrong. But, you know, we're deeply concerned about him because, A, we miss him. We're worried about him. And we just need to know that he's okay. You know, only this morning, you know, I might sound reasonably composed at this moment in time, but a few hours ago, I was anything but. You know, and I guess it's beginning to hit me now that the initial search is over and that the fundraiser is over. Now I have time to actually look back and reflect on my own needs and emotions, and the slightest little thing, it will set me off into tears, floods of tears.
Which you have to do, Pauline, to maintain your own resilience, you know, to let yourself slip wouldn't do anyone any favours, and I'm sure it's not what Luke would want either. So a big thank you for talking to us today, and mind yourself, and indeed regards to the family and Luke's girlfriend as well. I hope you can all keep as well as possible over the time until you get some clarity, and I hope you do, some clarity on this. 1-800-442-552 for the missing person's helpline. Thanks very much, Pauline. We'll take a break. We're back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Ruth Medjber, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you're well versed in hearing Take Me to Church, but it ended up with Take Me to the Emergency Room. Tell us why you were in the US and where you had to go.
Oh, you know, I've been in the US a lot the last couple of years because I've been travelling with Hozier. I'm a tour photographer, a music photographer, so I travel around with bands and take their photographs while they're doing their thing on stages. And I've been very, very lucky to be out with Hozier the last couple of years. We're in the States. It was great. We are 2.5 years into this tour. And then I had myself a little accident.
Right.
I stepped down off the stage and had to go to A&E, or the emergency room, as they call it.
You're a photographer. You're absorbed in your work. And you made one wrong step and injured ankle. How badly injured was the ankle?
Oh, it's a break. It was a break. There was no denying it. I broke the ankle. I stepped down off the stage, and it was a very rookie mistake, now I have to say, because usually I'm quite on the ball, but it was just that moment when the lights went off. I thought I was stepping onto a flat surface. It wasn't flat. My ankle went, and in slow motion, down I came. But I saved the cameras. I had two cameras in my hands. All good.
Okay. All right. Now, look, United Health Research says that an emergency room visit in the US costs anywhere between $1,500 and $3,000. And if you have to stay in hospital for 3 days, you could be looking at $30,000. But take us to the ambulance and you know, where the treatment began and what treatment began when you were in the ambulance.
You know what? It was actually, they were very good. They were very on the ball. From the medics that were there in the arena, they had me on a stretcher backstage. You know, I actually asked them to bring me backstage and not into the medical tent, because I was like, listen, we can fix this. You know, everyone here on tour is amazing that they do. They can fix this. And they were so good. They were instantly on the ball with the pain relief. They were like, are you in pain? Are you in pain? I was like, my version of pain is very different, I think. I was like, you know, I'm an Irish woman. We can take our pain. They're like, how is it on the scale of 1 to 10? I was like, creeping up there to an 8 or a 9. So they were straight in with the, they were like, do you want fentanyl or morphine? I was like, oh, dealer's choice. I'll take anything you've got. Like, and then the ambulance came, same question, fentanyl or morphine. I was like, keep on the fentanyl. Hospital, and we got to the emergency room, and, you know, they were very, very free flowing, shall I say. But then, of course, I suppose comes with implications, or comes with its own worries of, financial worries for me, you know. That's when my brain started ticking, like, oh my God, am I going to be able to afford all this fentanyl they're dishing out?
Yeah, because that for anyone who's been to an emergency room in the States, or for anyone who hasn't been in the emergency room in the States, every item that's given to you has a barcode, and it's scanned as they go. When did you realise the till or the meter was running on your hospital treatment?
I think it was the third time they asked me, would I like some more fentanyl? And I was like, why are you trying? This is, you know, they're on the hard sell here, I felt. So I was just like, wait, what's going on? And that's when it dawned on me, because at that point in the whole thing, I hadn't realized, you know, I hadn't actually just gone, oh, wait, I'm in America. This could be an issue, you know? And my head started ticking over to, like, my health insurance at home, is this going to cover this? You know, how am I going to afford this? That's where I kind of went, and I really kicked myself for not being more of a grown up and kind of saying, oh wait, yeah, you know, I'm well covered here. I know this X, Y, and Z. So my brain was in kind of overdrive. I was on fentanyl, I was away with the fairies, and then I was also scrambling to think, how can I afford this? Because when they wheeled me into the ER, like, the first person that actually really chatted to me was the guy from the finance department, the billing guy, to making sure. Yeah, he was straight in with his computer, like, what's your name, what's your address, do you have insurance, do you have this, do you have that, like absolutely making sure he got all my details. He was like, we can't let you go until you go to the billings department, we can't let you go until, and I was like, oh my God. And then I, thankfully now, because I'm on a tour full of really responsible adults and they're all amazing at their job, and we have a tour manager and a production manager and a stage manager, they were on the ball straight away saying, we're sending someone over with all of our insurance details, with the amazing credit card that's going to, you know, it basically unlocked access to the doctor, because I don't think I would have got access to the doctors unless I was absolutely insuranced up or had the means to pay. Like,
had you seen a doctor yet at that point?
No, I hadn't. Like, they kind of waved me in. They were like, you know, because obviously the ambulance dropped me off and they're like, what is it? They're like, suspected broken ankle. But I hadn't got an x-ray or anything, you know, at that stage. So it was very much, they're very, just very on the ball with the who you are and, you know, maybe, you know, are you resident here and everything, to questions, which I suppose they have to be, you know what I mean? Because you do hear of people skipping out on bills in America. You hear people going bankrupt in America and everything. So I guess they're very, you know, financially orientated, which is different to our situation here, I suppose. But it was a different experience. It was a whirlwind as well, which was gas. They had me out in 2 hours because they knew the tour bus was picking me up.
And come here, did things change when the cavalry arrived with the credit card?
Of course. Everything was expedited. So I was like, nope, she's going for it, go for it, yeah. Now, they weren't very busy at the time, which was grand, you know, and they were all lovely, lovely people. It was just, I guess it was that just shock, you know, that I could be one of those people that I read about that goes to America, has a really expensive injury, and then can't pay for it. So that was my biggest fear and my biggest concern. And thankfully, though, you know, I did have our entire crew to the rescue that could come and go, oh, listen, switch your brain off. You don't need to be worrying about this. You worry about getting better. We'll look after this.
And what do they do? What do they do? They stick a cast on, give you crutches. What kind of treatment did you end up needing to get?
Just the x-ray, they figured out it was a broken bone, torn ligaments. They put me in the boot, put me on crutches, gave me a prescription and sent me on my way, which was grand. It was perfect. That's kind of what I needed. I was in my like logistical tour brain where I was like, okay, I need to get to the next, I need to follow the tour bus. I can't miss the tour bus. I need to go. So that's all I really asked for them, you know, that was it.
you're a bit of a live wire, aren't you? There's no stopping you.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, I've been home for 3 weeks now with my foot elevated and I'm going bananas because I love working.
Did you keep going with the boot? Did you keep working for the rest of the tour?
No.
Or did you have to be restrained?
You know what? I had a stern talking to by my bosses and they were like, they didn't think I was taking it seriously enough because I wanted to keep going. Okay. I wanted to keep.
You were
keep
sent home, basically.
I was sent home. The tour, you know, it's my job. It's my baby. I wanted to be there. But they were like, Ruth, cop on. Will you go home? We're sending you home. Off you go. Go back and get yourself sorted in an Irish hospital. You know, get yourself re-x-rayed and come back to us when you're fit and able, which is great. I do need to be talked to sometimes like that. So
yeah, did you get to see the credit card bill? Do you know what the insurance of the credit card was hit up for?
I'm afraid to ask, to be honest. I haven't seen it and I think it's best I don't see it. But you know, I came home to Beaumont Hospital and I went and sat in A&E with them and it's just a whole different experience. It really is. It's, you know, and it was lovely as well because you're in a waiting room and it is packed and you're queuing for a little while, but the crack is kind of mighty. Everyone's in there chatting and you get a cup of tea and, you know, it's a completely different experience. They're like, of course they'll mind you. And I don't even think they asked me for ID in there.
Right. I think because I knew I'd be talking to you, I did a bit of a search. That research in the States says that a fracture, that's broadly what you have, isn't it? A fracture, yeah. Between a grand and 3,200 on the survey. But it turns out you were injured in Montana, weren't you?
It was, yeah. Yeah, Montana.
Well, I mean, it could have been worse. Montana, I think, is of 51 territories in the US, states and territories that were surveyed. Montana was number 48 in terms of expense. So you're down at the bottom of the league table, at the very least, on that one.
Okay.
So anyway, Beaumont which you've just given the big up for there, and I'm sure the staff there are very caring and very nice indeed. Did you make you see Beaumont in a whole new light?
You know, out of all, you can probably guess this, but I'm a bit accident prone and I do break bones, and it's a very physical job, so it's not the first time I've been through A&E with a break. And Beaumont will be my favourite of the A&Es in Dublin, shall we say.
Okay, you've got a well-stamped Beaumont loyalty card, have you?
I do, yeah. I think they know me by name now. But they're actually, you know, they're good crack. And that's what the doctor who saw me was just like, did you fly home? I was like, yeah. Did they not tell you that you can't fly home, that you've high risk of blood clots? And I was like, no one told me anything. Do you know, so I was there taking two connecting flights home with a big cast on me, and that apparently shouldn't be allowed, and all of this stuff. So they are very caring, you know, and then they set me up with physio, and you know, and there's no question, the physio guy was giving me a splint, and you know, really kind of thinking like, well, okay, well, how do you need to get around, and how do you, and when I went to leave the physio, I was like, how much do I owe you for the splint? And he was like, you don't. And I was like, oh wow. Yeah. I love Ireland.
Well, when you were asking about how you get around, you won't be getting around in the way that you prefer, which might also explain why you wind up in A&E so much. Go on, what's your hobby? You are what?
Oh, no. I love roller skating. You Who do? Doesn't love roller skating? It's a bit, I know, and I'm a bit long in the tooth for it. Like, I'm coming up fast on my 40s, but I love roller skating.
Never too old.
Core strength, you know, and it's supposed to be, I'm going to get back on the skates as soon as I can to strengthen up my ankles, and then there'll be no stopping me.
You haven't
Maybe
strapped one on
bummer.
Over the boot, have you?
You know what? The size of my foot, it's not going to fit.
Okay. I can only recall my only one experience I had with an emergency room in the US was my eldest fella, when he was just shy of two, fell down a few steps. But I checked the insurance detail on the way to the hospital because he burst open his lip. And the small print on the insurance, the travel insurance, was ring your insurer on the way to the hospital and tell them you will be presenting at hospital. And then they give you a claim number, which you give to the billing department when you land at the hospital. And the insurer I was dealing with lost the claim number, but luckily I'd written it down in a notebook and was able to come back to them. And they settled directly with the hospital. But had they not settled directly with the hospital, the three stitches that he got in his lip would have cost, I think it was somewhere between 12 and 1400 euro.
Wow.
So that was they gave him an anaesthetic jab before the stitch, so they beeped that off on the barcode, and then all of the plasters, all of the dressings, all of their own individual barcode, and they got all beeped off, and then obviously there was the labour cost as well. So there you go.
It all adds up, and you need to really have the wherewithal when you're in that situation to call the insurance company. And like, not a lot of people do. I definitely didn't. Do you know, I was on a stretcher dealing with immense pain, and the last thing I was.
You weren't just on a stretcher; you were on fentanyl as well.
I was on fentanyl, yeah.
Which is probably not the right way to be trying to navigate any bureaucracy.
No. Not to be going through my emails looking for what my insurance covers. Definitely not. Like,
but look, you know, you've got your foot up. It's not the first time you've had to, you know, spend time in splendid isolation in your life. The last time you wound up in an isolated situation, you made a book out of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were all living in lockdown at the time, and I, of course, was out of a job because there was no gigs. No gigs means no work for me. So I started photographing people. Now, it's 2020. I started photographing people through their windows at twilight, you know, just on the cusp of nighttime. And I made a book called Twilight Together, and it really saved me in so many ways. It saved my sanity, saved my finances, and I think it resonated a lot with Irish people who were also stuck home at the time. So I was very, you know, I kind of made the best of that bad situation. And, you know, actually, surprisingly enough, I've been sitting here for the last 3 weeks with my foot up, and I'm planning my next book. So I've actually gotten to grips with that, put in a few Arts Council applications. So I'm using the time well. I love isolation, apparently.
Okay. And so what's the crack with the tour then? What's the prognosis on the leg? Do you have to hold off flying? Do you get to rejoin the tour at any point?
You know, I get to rejoin the tour. They're all still out there. They're plodding along. They have a lovely stand-in photographer for me. But I hope to be back this week as soon as I get to see my GP and they sign me back to my feet again, and off I go. So, yeah,
so
dying to get back.
How soon are you going back?
Maybe this week, if he allows me. I'm going to ask. I can only just ask. I think I'm going to be fine, hopefully, this week.
Right, so that's 3 weeks on, is it?
It'll be 4 weeks. It'll be 4 weeks since it happened that I get to go back. So keep the fingers crossed and the candles lit.
And how's the pain?
grand, gone. Not a bother on me. I'm a quick healer. It's all in my mind.
You would say that anyway, because you want to go back.
I know. Yeah. I do want to go back. What's the new book? I love the crew. So the new book, it's going to be kind of, you know what, I'm not going to say a lot, but it's going to be massive. And I'm going to have an open call for all of Ireland to participate in it, from all of Ireland and the islands. I want to do a great big document of Irish people in 2026. So I'll be announcing that in my column in the Indo in a couple of weeks' time. And I'd love to hear from everyone across Ireland if they want to be in this project. So
okay. All right. Well, look, the very best of luck with your recovery. And I hope there is no long lasting impact on it. There's no point in me saying to keep busy, because I don't think there's any stopping you.
No. Thank you so much. I appreciate chatting to you today. It's been lovely.
Not at all. And it should be said, you do write a column in the Indo, which you've not been a full feet up experience. You did write about your experience in your column in the Indo as well. So you never stop.
Yeah.
All right. Look,
I
thanks
don't.
A million.
All right.
Thanks, Ruth.
Thanks
all
so
the
much.
Best.
Mind
all
yourself.
The best.
Bye.
Good luck. See you. Bye. We are. Yeah, sorry, James, good afternoon to you.
Colin, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Now, you were listening to us last week and the various experiences people were telling us about of trying to deal with banking and financial bureaucracy on behalf of a loved one. What's your own situation?
Well, my mother's, she's in her 90s. And we're trying to get power of attorney sorted for her so that we can look after her in case the worst comes to the worst and she loses some of her facilities and she can't make a decision, because that happened to one of my relatives and they had a bit of land and they couldn't sell the house because their mother had lost her facilities. She had dementia.
Right, okay.
So therefore, nobody could do anything. Couldn't sell the land. Couldn't change the polio. Couldn't do anything until power of attorney would have been in place. But it was too late at that stage to get power of attorney.
Okay.
So we said, okay, look, as my niece actually said to me, like, get this sorted so that it never happens to Gran. So I just said, okay, in theory, it's a decision support service website, but it's done through gov.ie or gov.ie. In theory, you're supposed to be able to do it yourself. So about a year ago or 9 months ago, whatever it was, thought, right, well, we'll get this done, get it signed, get it all signed off, and that'll be that, done out of the way. I've done other stuff for Mum, got her the house ready because she had the fall, and got the house ready for wheelchairs, and
right.
Got the government grants for that, and done all this kind of stuff that you do, and all of those are, you know, they're tricky enough, but you get them, you can do them, they're possible. So I'm not computer illiterate, I've got degrees in engineering and bits and pieces, but when I went to do this decision support service website to try and set up the attorney, power of attorney, impossible, still haven't done it. Went to a solicitor. Solicitor got to the stage where we could. He managed to get the forms downloaded. Now we can't upload the forms. We got the forms downloaded and witnessed the whole lot. Then you go back to try and upload the forms. Gone to solicitor as well. He can't do it. We can't do it.
All right.
It's just completely user unfriendly.
Okay, well, we've got in contact with them because obviously we give them the right to reply when we're in touch with you. And the Decision Support Service says the accessible online portal for the Decision Support Service is working as intended and the user-friendly upload button is functioning correctly. The DSS provides a range of supports to persons using our online portal. These include videos, step-by-step guides, guidance material and frequently asked questions. The DSS Information Services team answers queries and supports users via free phone line at 01211 9750, and also has a dedicated and enduring power of attorney help desk to specifically support EPA applicants, that's enduring power of attorney, to make and submit an EPA for registration. Now, did you try any and all of those avenues?
Tried all those avenues, tried the phones, couldn't get any luck on the phones. tried an email, nothing came back with the email. And that's when we decided then, okay, let's go with solicitor. Solicitor will help. But what they're saying about, like, I sent your column, I sent your
the team, yeah.
Or your team there. I sent them the screenshots of what's coming up on my screen. And it clearly shows that that's not true. The button, it doesn't work.
Right.
You push the button to upload the documents, it doesn't work. You can get one step, which is download the documents. You can't get the next steps. Now, I'm not stupid. Like, I have my qualifications. So, like, you could understand if you're not familiar with computers or that kind of stuff, then maybe you could see an issue. But that's not the case. And secondly, there's going to be an awful lot of people in Ireland, obviously, where this is... People don't realise this, firstly. And secondly... they're not going to be able to do it themselves because if I can't do it, well, I'm not saying if I can't do it, nobody can do it.
And did your solicitor manage it?
No, he's not. He hasn't.
Right. Okay, all right, James. Well, look, I mean, we've raised it. There may be other people out there, 087 484 8888, who've had a similar difficulty with this in trying to register with the Decision Support Service and upload the necessary documentation. And as I say, I've given you the reply that the Decision Support Service has given us on enduring power of the attorney. So if you have anything to add to what James was telling us, 087 484 8888, and the DSS says the user-friendly upload button is working. What's your experience? Get in touch. We'll take a break. We're back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Now, we had an amazing tale of teenagers to the rescue there. You might have heard it. About a week ago, we were talking to a group of teenagers. There were three of them out on the pier in Rosslare. There was another group of teenagers who were going to go swimming. They warned them about the current. They didn't listen to them. They ended up out to sea. The teenagers who were fishing called the rescue services, and it all ended well. This time, another tale of a teenager to the rescue. Caoimhe Moroney, good afternoon to you.
Hiya, how are you?
I'm not too bad, thanks. Not in the southeast this time, but in the Midwest, in County Clare. You were in Ballyvaughan.
Yeah, in Bishop's Quarter Beach, Ballyvaughan, yeah.
Okay, so Friday the 11th of July at about 4:30, what happened?
Yeah, so I suppose, like, I was just there with my family because it was a fine day, so... We were at the beach anyway. We were kind of gathering ourselves to leave nearly. And next thing, my mum heard this, well, yeah, elderly man shouting, like. And then I kind of looked at mum and I said, oh, is he shouting from, like, the cold of the water? Or is he, like, actually in trouble? And mum was like, I think he's actually in trouble because... And then I said, all right, so I go out. And she was like, yeah. So I have these... I do surf lifesaving with Clare Water Safety, so I had my board there and I just went out to him and, like, went talking to him, was like, you're going to be grand or whatever.
Okay.
And then I suppose I just went over to him with the board and said, like, oh, grab onto that so it'll float, you know what I mean?
And how far out was he?
I'd say about, like, 25 or 30 metres maybe.
So you made your way out on the board. Did you have any, I mean, what's the water like out there? Is it particularly deep or is it an awkward stretch of water?
It's a nice beach and it stays kind of shallow, but it's known for having like sandbanks and dips. So it can be 3 foot deep 1 minute and then you take another step and it can be like 8 foot deep. It can kind of like drop, if you know what
okay.
I mean.
And tell us, what did you've done, as you say, water safety course and you had the board. So when somebody's in trouble, that can sometimes be dangerous for the rescuer as well. So as you were paddling your board out, what's the right approach and what was going through your head from your training?
Well, I suppose, like, it's been drilled into us from, like, a young age as well. Like, just never go near anyone if you don't have, like, anything... that would like float, because if someone's drowning they're so desperate and they're just like panicking and they don't know what to do
and they might grab hold of you in the mistaken impression that they can push themselves up, but it's going to get the rescuer in trouble unless they're an experienced person.
So you a lot of the times around the country more people drown like trying to save someone than the actual person drowning in the beginning.
Okay. So anyway, you brought the board out. Meanwhile, Aisling Moroney, your mother, is watching from the shore. Aisling, take us back to the 11th of July at 4:30. Caoimhe is paddling her way out on the board into the water towards this man. You're standing on the shore. What were you thinking?
I suppose I have full trust in her, and I knew that she could do it. So I just said a prayer or two and hoped for the best after that. Then I knew she was succeeding, and we knew it was positive from the distance. So I didn't get worried. Yes, said a prayer or two, but I knew she was well able to do it, and I put my trust in her.
Right. And was it yourself signed her up for the water safety courses?
Yes.
And what made you decide on that? Was she a keen swimmer, or was it just, do you live beside the water? Are you from that area? Is that why you decided it was a necessary step?
Yeah, I think it's a very important skill for all young people and all people really to have. Yeah, we're from the north there, which would be about a half an hour or 20 minutes from the sea.
Okay.
So it's a skill that all young people should have, and maybe even in transition year programs, they should be doing it, I would say, definitely, to increase their skill level and to improve their confidence within the water.
And how long is she, when did you sign her up? What age was she when you signed her up to it first?
Say we've done water safety back in White Strand. I'd say since Caoimhe was about 8, so about 7 or 8 years ago.
Okay, your line is slightly underwater there, so we'll go back to Caoimhe. So Caoimhe, you paddled the boat out to him, and you said you had a conversation with him to kind of reassure him first. You had to talk him through then how you were going to bring him back to shore. Did he have to climb on the board, or did you tell him to hang on? And how did you calm him down before any of that was able to sink in?
I know, it was kind of more so like, because I knew I'd be like well able to swim anyway, so I kind of got off the board and then let him like hold on to it so it would float, you know what I mean?
Okay. So you got him, at what stage was he in when you got the board out from? Was he in a bit of a panic?
Yeah, like he was panicking, like, yeah.
And did you try and get him up on the board, or did he just hang on to it?
Well, I thought that would be a bit too much, okay. Like, hassle, you know what I mean? But then I just said, like, oh, hold on to it, like, because it'll keep you afloat anyway, you know what I mean?
And did you swim along beside him till he got to the shore?
Yeah, I kind of pushed it then as well.
Okay. And did you have to talk to him the whole time? Is there an element of kind of reassurance and talking him out of the panic and reassuring him the whole time? Do you have to do a bit of a constant commentary when you're dealing with somebody in a situation like that?
Yeah, well, that's what we're kind of taught to do for, like, our exams. And, like, because the way we do the water safety, you'll do, like, a week of a course every year. And then we'll say Monday to Friday a week. And then on the Friday, you'll do, like, kind of an exam. And we were always told, like, oh, make sure you're shouting in the exam and, like, speaking and everything, because that's, like, really important.
And when you say an exam, it's not a paper. They kind of replicate that situation in the water, and an experienced lifeguard pretends to be the drowning person, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. And would you recommend the water safety course that you've took? I mean, you're, what, 15 now, and you started when you were about 8. Would you recommend it to other children?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, it's so important. Like, because, like, the amount of people that wouldn't know how to swim, wouldn't know what to do in that situation is just, like, it's mental. Like, there's only a few people. Like, there isn't that many people doing it, and it's, really, it's not good enough that there's such little people doing it.
Right. And have you more steps to complete? What kind of grade, if that's the right word, are you at now? And
yeah,
how much further is there to go?
Well, you kind of start in safety one, but before that you do, like, more swimming lessons in the sea, really. But then once you get to safety one, when you're about, like, 10, I'd say, you have to do safety 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then you do rescue 1, 2, and 3. And then I'll be doing rescue 2 this year.
Okay. So you're going to go all the way, are you?
I'd say so, yeah.
Brilliant. And possibly a summer job out of it maybe at some point?
Hopefully, yeah. So you have to be 18 to be a qualified lifeguard in the sea, but you can lifeguard in certain pools when you're 16. So
okay.
We'll see.
All right. Well, you're fantastic and fair play. And I'm sure the person that you guided safely to the shore was very grateful to you by the time you got him to the shallower water and the shore in the end.
Yeah, I suppose he was grand. Like, he was
okay. He
was so grateful, and his wife was there too, and they were just so nice. Like,
right, you're very chilled about it. Fair play to you, Anna. No doubt your mother, Aisling, is very proud as well.
Yeah.
Proud mommy, Aisling.
Yes, of course. And her dad, Michael, and her brother, Dara.
Fair play. OK, shout out to the whole family. All very proud of you there, Caoimhe. So fair play to you, and glad to hear all of that ended well. We'll take a break. We're back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Back to the DSS EPA, to paraphrase the Beatles. That's the Decision Support Service and the Enduring Power of Attorney. We were listening to James about 10 minutes ago. Sally Clifford, you were... looking to get registered and set up with the Decision Support Service as well. Hi, how are you?
Yeah, hi, not bad at all. Yeah, no, my position is that I became a widow last year and decided to get my affairs in order.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Thank you. When I went to my solicitor or emailed him, he said, sorry, we don't do that anymore. We have to go. We're not allowed to by the Law Society. Apparently, there's been lots of legal to-ing and fro-ing with it. So go to the DSS.ie. I said, fine, no problem. When you go to log in, the whole procedure is completely very overwhelming, and I am computer literate. I do a lot on computers. I even watched the health video, which goes on for about 20 minutes, and it explains all the different stages you go through, but there are just far, far too many stages. You have to get everything signed at different stages, back again, get it witnessed, etc., etc., and it is just, I feel, not fit for purpose. It is very, very much off-putting for people that it's aimed for of my age, and I don't think it should have been set up as is, and I don't see why you can't really go to your solicitor, fill in various forms there, or fill them in and get him to witness, and him or her to witness or sign them off. So eventually what I did was I had heard about the Irish Hospice Foundation have a lovely document, a customer-friendly document that you fill in for your various wishes at the end stages of life, and just your day-to-day wishes, where you would like to be minded and taken care of, etc., etc. Very, very customer friendly, and which I have done that, and that's in on the various files of my children, and they know what I need at the end stages, and
okay.
So I'm very pleased of having done that.
And did you have to register that with your solicitor?
No, it is not. It's not a legally binding document, and it wouldn't apply where you had a lot of maybe monetary problems or things that have to be sorted out. But, I mean, I have wills, etc. sorted, so that's not a worry to me. But it's just I thought I would be doing correctly by going through the DSS.ie. But as I say, I gave up after 3 or 4 weeks of attempting to work my way through thing. And this,
you probably heard me say at the end, and I'm sorry to cut across you there, when I was talking to James there, that they say the accessible online portal is working as intended and the user-friendly upload button is functioning correctly. But they say that's it working as intended. You would say that...
I disagree, and I've said it to a few of my friends of my own age, and they're in the same boat as well. Maybe the people that they see managing to work their way through haven't got on to complain, but I'd say it's a small proportion of the number of people who would like to get it done.
Okay. Well, they've been in touch with us on foot of having heard James talking to us, and they passed us on a phone number to pass on to James, and we if you stay on the line,
helpline.
It's a phone number that that they've asked us to pass on to James. They did give us a helpline in the statement, but I'm not sure if it's the same number. But if you do stay on the line, one of the team will be able to give it to you after we come off air.
I appreciate that. That's very good. And thank you for highlighting the whole issue.
Not at all. It's the EPA help desk, we're told. It's a number for that. The number they gave us was 211-9750, the Dublin number 01211-9750. I don't know if it's the same difference, but the team will pass it on to you in any case.
So they're doing their best to try and make it, but I just feel that the way it was initially set up is far too onerous.
Okay. All right.
So,
well,
thank you very much,
Sally.
Paul.
Thanks very much for talking to us. That's our lot
bye
for
bye.
Today.
No problem.
Thanks.
Bye.